Hello, everybody. This is the Gingerbread Man, and I would like to welcome you to my home. So thank you for being here. I appreciate you showing up. I always enjoy this ritual of figuring out what I'm going to say and how I'm going to do things. And I tend to do this in the morning, and so my brain is fresh and it's vibrant, and I'm seeing everything directly in front of me, all the different possible choices and tasks that are lined up. And it's just so nice to have this outlet. And so I want to start off by just telling you thank you and telling you how grateful I am that you're providing me this opportunity to try to have a platform to try to assist people and to try to be a source of help, of encouragement. I want to delve into the world of our psyches and the world, this physical thing that's we're all walking around on, like a round egg spinning around the solar system. I want to have other people encouraged to do this for themselves and to find all the different facets of their being. A big thing that we all have to deal with is this existential dread that's part of life that I like to call fear. And fear has a lot of different ways that it shows itself in reality. But fear is the seed for so many other emotions. And all these emotions build on each other, and then they turn into choices, and they turn into actions, and then they decay into memory. And then we look back on it, and we see where we've come and how far we've been. And that takes a certain degree of awareness or attention and a readiness to hold the darker pieces and parts of ourselves that we don't usually interact with. And recently on the show, I've been calling that little bit the shadow, which is a Jungian term. That'd be Carl Jung, the father of certain types of psychotherapeutic theory, but most essentially the archetype. And the shadow is this archetype for all of our darkness. Every single being on this planet is walking around with a need, a want, a desire, this crushing dependency on something. And that's what I think is a crucial component and fear being born is this wanting desire. And that hole in our hearts, I also heard somebody else describe this week as some sort of wound. And temporally, I'm not sure if there's a time ticket on this essential wound, really. But I do think that there's something that's hurting and that's crying for something, for some sort of soothing. And in such a material world that's driven by consuming things, I think it's really easy to learn that all we have to do to feel better is to take this thing, take this pill, you know, consume this TV show, or take this substance that's going to chemically change who I am. But the most crucial part of this that has resonated with me is that every one of us is walking around in this condition, and we're doing different things to bandage our wound or fill our hole. Sometimes much more literally than figuratively in that latter statement. But I want people to look at this and see the cyclical nature to what it is to be our creature. We have an immense power to look at ourselves and to see these things, these components, this emotional internal weather. And when it comes to like one of my favorite topics, which is going to be psychedelia, especially with new users who are entering this world, and psychedelia would be this material component. It is a physical substance. It's an object. It's a molecule. It's a thing. It's a thing that we take to incur some sort of change. And the word psychedelic goes back, etymologically speaking, to the meaning of mind expansion, mind opening. And in this sort of expansion and opening, metaphorically, I like to think of a flower, some sort of petal, a floral progression as each one opens up in sequence. But the sequence of its opening is its existence. And it's a short thing, and then it goes away, and then another flower comes. So there's a cyclical nature to all this thing as well. But when somebody who's used to their default brain, who has learned their personality to a certain extent, who is not chemically driven for curiosity's sake, once that person comes and approaches psychedelia, there's this concurrent appearance of this essential part of life, fear. And even as a regular user myself, I still experience butterflies and stress and a little bit of fear every time I go into that part of me using these chemical tools as a key to open these doors. So I was trying to explain to somebody last night how and what to expect and my sort of ideas on what a psychedelic is. Primarily dimethyltryptamine, which is DMT, which is close to my heart. And also through the lens of psilocybin, which breaks down into psilocin, which is another structural compound that's dear to my heart. And I always tell people these two compounds are like kissing cousins, because if you take a serotonin molecule and you were to look at it with a layman's eye and compare it to both dimethyltryptamine and psilocybin, they're very, very, very similar. And it's almost like it's like the secret. You know, every time I ever looked at them, I'd be like, ah, gotcha, look at this. You know, it's intimately bound to serotonin. And there's a lot of different types of serotonin receptors. The one that scientists are having a hard-on for now is the 5-HT2A receptor, which implies there's a 5-HT2-1, and there's all kinds of other 5-HTs. 5-HT being 5-hydroxytryptamine, which is another name for serotonin. So most other substances either heighten this persona in a stimulatory fashion, such as caffeine or methamphetamine, and stimulants work through, they think, dopamine, but probably a lot of other pathways as well, to incur this state of mind that in Indian ethos would be called manas consciousness, which is like power consciousness. And once we really start to channel what we are, you know, we have an immense ocean of abyssal immensity on the inside of us that some would call the unconscious. There's so much of everything just on the other side of this little me and inside of you. And so I'm of the opinion, theoretically, that when we enter states of mind where we incur more of this energy and we start to channel it through us, this is stimulatory in our actions and in our efforts. And so that's kind of how I see stimulants, is just channeling more power, which you don't need a substance to do that. You know, I find so much heart and so much sake and caring about my coworkers that often I can push myself very hard, even when I'm sober, and I can find these spaces of power and I can be very stimulated, but I've never had a hard time stimulating myself. So when I take a stimulant, it's usually way too much and it feels like I'm the burnt ends, and then I'm being, you know, like a firecracker and all my brain cells just bursting away. And then you have the opposite end of that extreme with depressants, which are dampeners, ignorance pills or cocktails, and things like alcohol or Xanax or heroin or opiates. These are depressants that slow down general functions, and I think that they kind of like, they slow us down so much that it's hard for us to tap into that universal ethos that exists on the inside of us. And so if there's a lot of parts that you don't want to come into contact with, and there's pieces that you're repressing, that you're pushing away from you, these pieces that you're locking away, and the only place you can lock them away is in your unconscious. Once you've thrown away the key, they can easily slip out at any point in time. And so instead of facing these things, we can put up dampeners and we can put up additional walls of defense between us and our insides. And that's kind of how I see the general effect of what these depressants are doing. And so all of a sudden you can just linger on meanness and this selfishness, not in like a negative context, but like selfliness, like I'm sitting in this context of I. And once divorced from all that, that can be good or bad, but sometimes it can be inhibitory and that can feel nice. So that's kind of how I see these effects, theoretically, from my own perspective. These are all just my ruminations. So then you have psychedelia. And it's like, there's like a thin vizier, a thin wall, a curtain of some sort between the captain's chair, the personality seat, and all of the rest of the unconscious of who we all are. And what I think serotonergic drugs do is they mess with the back and forth travel of that. And sometimes it's dramatic. Sometimes it can have a lot of narrative, if you understand my drift. So, either when we are exposed to the darkness, and it's not always just shameful, it's not always just the things we've walked away. Sometimes it's memory, sometimes it's nostalgia, sometimes it's moments in time that we haven't thought about in forever. Old aspirations. Old ideals, old theories for me. And once we come in contact with that, there's a moment where we can accept it. And through that door of acceptance is the rest of eternity. And by that, I mean just pure bliss and joy, if that's your thing, but also pure understanding and pure ability to just be in a moment without having to do anything. One of the first times I took a really large amount of mushrooms several years ago, I had this dramatic 5-hour experience where I was traumatically looking for something to do. And my little ego couldn't find anything interesting. And so that made me terribly sad because I didn't know what I was meant to be for. And unfortunately, all I could do in that moment was just be myself and be in that moment. And I wasn't used to that. And I didn't know how to hold that. And so it terrified me. Now, snap forward almost 10 years later, when I find that space, I'm just grateful that I don't have to keep beating the horse to keep it running forward, if that makes any sense. So there's a potential for acceptance of who we are that is argued to us by fear. Remember, this argument's coming to us through fear. And so emotionally, we have to take this thing, this response of potential terror, and alchemize it and transmute it into understanding, which would be in Indian mythos, jhana, or wisdom. But the opposite side of the same coin with one experience, which is this fear, is what I would consider a panic response. And this panic response is not isolated to chemicals. There's nothing to do with getting high. It's not, strictly speaking, a part of the psychedelic experience. This panic response can happen when you're sober. It's a physical ability of the body in response to fear, which is endemic to life. We are perpetually being exposed to new opportunities for fear. That's the human condition. And it's our power and our choice to alchemize it into this moment of acceptance. And if that is unable to happen, then that's where this panic response is born. And part of the reason that I appreciate psychedelics from their material place in our practice, philosophically and theoretically, is that they give us an opportunity to confront this fear response on purpose. Because in regular life, if we're just going about doing our thing, when panic comes, when we're exposed to fear, it's subtle because we didn't take anything. We didn't do anything. We might have been happy. And that's a sneaky point too, is when you're really digging it, you're really vibing with life. You're in a positive place. Tao says, when things go up, they fall down. And so at your happiest point is a great opportunity for the world to insert some sort of fearful entity. And that might be in the format of a disagreement with a coworker or a loved one. It might be with a behavioral response from your child at school, so you have to go pick them up. It might be a financial stressor because you broke something on your car haphazardly and now you have to go pay for it. And where are you going to get groceries now? There's so many different subtle ways that fear can be inserted into our world. And it's a great opportunity when you're really digging it, man. That's what I found, is that when I'm on my happiest is when I can follow my furthest, because that's when I'm not expecting it. But psychedelics, you could take a gram or two of psilocybic mushrooms, and there's this doorway of potential fear because you have to accept it or not. And that's what everybody's afraid of when it comes to these things. Especially older, or not older, fucking newer users, like brand new novel peoples, the psychedelic babies. These people are terrified of having a bad trip because they are terrified of themselves. And they know it. They've heard about it from other people. There's so many weird, you know, fictionalized ideas of a bad trip, of a bad experience. You know, and I don't like most of that shit because most of it's too dramatic. Because it's a simple choice. You either you take it or you don't. You accept what life is, or you don't. And this is this perpetual choice. It's not dragons and it's not Mickey Mouse with a steak knife crawling out of your corner. It's all the standard boring uncomfortabilities that you don't like about your life. But alchemy is taking that and turning it into something useful or validating. And for me, it's taking pain, it's taking uncomfortability and turning it into expression so that I can try to reach you or all the other people in my life. So I can try to understand humans, to understand why, what are we doing, you know? So I take that uncomfortable tension and friction and energy and I turn it into a need to make something, to make some form of expression so I can try to communicate with the world, with you, with the other. And for me, that's how I talk to God. And then on the other end of that coin is listening and hearing what the next step is. And that's always an argument from fear. And that's this lens of this physical thing, this material thing. But I'd also like to say on the end of this little conversation is that none of this has to do with drugs at all. I happen to just be fascinated by drugs, especially psychedelic compounds and hallucinogens. And I'm not sure if I'll ever stop and if I'll ever stop being curious, because they seem to be such a helpful, crucial tool for bending ways to see light in a different prismatic function. So my interest metaphorically to express this topic is purely just an interest. And I want to say again that this idea has nothing to do with drugs. All of these experiences and metaphors can happen to sober people in everyday regular lives. This idea of acceptance or panic, this two-sided coin, this one thing. One side of the coin is joy, understanding, and forward. The other side is panic and denial and repression. But it all comes from one moment, one argument that we express to ourselves. That's what confounds me and what's interesting. And that's the idea that I'm really trying to portray here through a lens of substance use. And also arguing that I don't think substance use is negative either, but that's another argument for another day. So, yeah, how can we look at the cycles and the waves, how a wave comes up on shore, how things ebb and flow like a tide? High tide, low tide, up, down, negative, positive, happy, sad. Look at all these different things that we roller coaster ourselves through. And maybe see how you can look at these moments and judge yourself differently. I'm trying to do that for myself. Well, I'm going to stop rambling here, and I'm going to go find a book, and I'll do a quote, and then we'll go get Odin, and then I'll sign you off for the day. I really appreciate you sitting here with me and taking your time to listen to my dribble. Just know that I'm doing it for you, and that if you'd like to message me and have an actual conversation or a discourse at any moment, you can email me at my email address, which is thegingerbreadmansdialogues. That's a mouthful, so you can find it in the show description. No matter where you find the show can be found anywhere else. So please share. Let other people hear the message so that they can have an opportunity maybe to have a disagreement with me. And I hope you have a wonderful week. So I'm going to go from a little bit different direction this week. This is from my book on dreaming, which is all about, not dreaming, it's all on sleep. Dreaming is just one part of sleep. But I've always been confounded by some people can so lucidly remember their dreams and I can't. And this is at the beginning of the chapter describing a much longer explanation on that. So here we go. There's one additional argument for associating REM sleep with dreaming. Awakenings made during non-REM sleep, only a few minutes after the termination of a REM period, produce very little dream recall. DeMint and Kleitman report that the incident of dream recall dropped precipitously, almost immediately upon cessation of REMs. In another investigation, it was reported that during ascending stage one sleep, 85% of awakenings produced detailed recall, while awakenings made within 5 minutes after the termination of ascending stage one sleep produced no instance of detailed recall, ascending stage one sleep here being REM sleep. It is obvious then that unless a subject is awakened during a REM period, he is likely to forget the mental content then experienced. Much of everyday dream recall produced comes from REM periods that happen to be experienced just before waking up. Since one is seldom awakened during earlier REM periods, a natural process of forgetting their mental contact occurs. One of the great values of the experimental study of dreaming when the EEG is used is that many of these early night dreams, which would otherwise be totally forgotten, can be detected, and when awakens are made, their content is recorded. Though it is obvious that REM period dreams are forgotten within the termination of that stage, it is far from clear why this is so. It has been suggested that non-REM sleep does not provide adequate neural conditions for the memory traces of REM mentation to consolidate. A like process may be observed when a blow on the head apparently interferes with neural process and causes retrograde amnesia, the forgetting of events experienced just prior to receiving the shock. In both cases, it is alleged that the neural processes are in some manner not adequate for the transformation of short-term memories into long-term ones. Modern theory, however, stresses that failure of memories are less often due to the absence of relevant memory traces than to failure to make such traces available to conscious memory. Under extraordinary circumstances, for example, direct electrical stimulation of the temporal lobe of the brain, vivid memories that have been hitherto inaccessible may be retrieved. Subconscious. One wonders whether trace unavailability rather than trace absence might not be the case with REM period dreams as well. There are suggestions in the reference sometimes made in subsequent dreams to previous ones and in apparent deja vu experiences, those feelings that one has encountered a situation before, although he is not sure when or where, and wakefulness that are later traced back to hitherto forgotten dreams. That REM period dreams do leave adequate memory traces. There must be something still unknown about the way in which these traces are filed that renders them generally inaccessible to consciousness, unless wakefulness intervenes very soon after the original impressions are experienced. So basically, it depends on if you're paying attention and if you're in a dream state where your mind is gone, at least this aspect of the personality, the ego is kind of divorced from it, or at least this section of the ego, then nobody's paying attention. And it's a situation like if a tree falls in the forest and nobody's there to hear it, does it make a sound? Only apply that to your dreams. Stuff to think about. All right, I'm gonna go grab Odo.
Hello guys, it's me today, and the gingerbread man, just asked me to fight a decision.
A decision?
It can help people.
Oh, advice.
Advice. Well, there's a lot of things that could help people. There is, helping, being good to the world, go outside to help your body. Actually, about go outside. And, that.
Oh, yeah?
Yes.
Good stuff. I like it. Very conscientious.
Yep.
Thank you, Boom.
Yes.
Love you.